The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from theteenmagazine.com and teenvogue.com. Our first article today from theteenmagazine.com. Here's everything you need to know about Ivy League schools. And this article was written by Williana Serve. I'm sure everyone has heard of the term Ivy League before, but what does it truly mean? If you ask the countless number of aspiring students and people around, you would think that the Ivy League is associated with elitism, prestige, tradition, power, and being the best of the best. Heck, it's even associated with getting the best education in America. These rumors are only partially true, to some extent. However, the Ivy League actually comes from more humble roots than the extravagant reputation it's garnered now. History. The Ivy League comprises 8 universities: Yale, Harvard, Princeton, Columbia, Cornell, University of Pennsylvania, Dartmouth, and Brown. The term Ivy League dates back to 1954, when the NCAA Athletic Conference for Division I was formed. Back then, their prestige didn't come from who had the best alumni network and donated the most, but stemmed from sports such as football and basketball. Even though the name has recently gained popularity, it's important to note that these 8 universities have a rich history going back as early as the 1600s. 2 New York Herald sports writers, Caswell Adams and Stanley Woodward, coined the name. It was initially used as a phrase in the 1933 article referring to these schools as Ivy Colleges. Caswell Adams used the term again during the football game coverage between Columbia and Penn. Caswell was a Fordham alumnus who showed great pride for his school to the point where the word Ivy Covered was used as an insult toward the match. Fordham, at the time, was a massive football powerhouse, so imagine Adams's disappointment when he didn't get to cover his alma mater. But hey, all publicity is good publicity. Note, the origin of the term and its adoption to shape the brand we know today is still a subject of ongoing debate and speculation. Back in the day, the Ivies mainly consisted of wealthy colonial men studying for law or church careers. They would study rhetoric, mathematics, and Latin, with the students held to a stricter standard back then. In current times, students would face probation or even expulsion. But in the 1600s to early 1700s, they administered ear boxing and public whippings to those who stepped out of line. Harvard even went as far as to implement a fee for those who swore or brought alcohol on campus. The diversity many of these schools brag about now was non-existent for centuries. The student body primarily consisted of those who were white, rich, and male. While things have drastically changed from the 1900s prior, privileged students make up a large percentage of Ivy League alums/attendees. Many of the Ivies did not even admit women until the 1960s to 1970s. Now that we've gone through the history of how the Ivy League came to be, here is a list of the 8 schools and their own individual histories. Harvard. Do we really need an introduction? The school that most people dream of attending, and the school that also has the largest donation size. Harvard is the oldest and one of the most reputable universities in the country. It was founded on September 8, 1636, by a vote by the Great and General Court of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. It was named after one of its first beneficiaries, John Harvard. Located in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Harvard educated 8 U.S. presidents and has 1 undergraduate college, Harvard College, along with 12 other graduate schools. Yale. Ah, Rory Gilmore's alma mater, Harvard's direct competitor. Yale was born later on, in 1701, alongside the founding of the New Haven colony in 1638 by a band of 500 Puritans who fled from persecution in Anglican England. It was named in honor of a Welsh merchant, Elihu Yale, for donating 417 books, a portrait of King George I, and proceeds from sales that he made. Yale made history by being the first institution to offer graduate degrees, which UPenn, Harvard, and Princeton followed shortly afterward. Yale offers 14 graduate/professional programs, with its Graduate School of Arts and Sciences having MA, MS, MPhil, and PhD degrees in 73 departments and programs. Yale is infamously known for their extensive library, which is the topic of jealousy. Offering 4 million volumes, they have an extreme security measure if a fire occurs, where they have a fire suppression system that sucks the oxygen out of the surrounding area to avoid destroying any of these valuable books. They also have a better dining hall. Sorry, Harvard. University of Pennsylvania. In Philadelphia, most people think of Philly cheesesteaks and roast pork sandwiches, but behind it is a rich history with a history-filled school that lies in the middle. The University of Pennsylvania was originally founded in 1740 as a charity school, primarily due to Benjamin Franklin's help. Commonly known as UPenn or Penn, not to be confused with Penn State, UPenn is home to many notable alumni/students such as John Legend, Elon Musk, and our favorite Stranger Things star, Noah Schnapp. Famously known for its cutting-edge business school, Wharton, UPenn has 12 schools in total, including its law and medical programs. Princeton. Devi Vishwakumar's dream school, or the missing piece to the Holy Trinity, HYP, whichever name you decide to adopt, Princeton is notorious in many ways. Chartered in 1746, it was known as the College of New Jersey until 1896 before adopting the name Princeton after relocating to its new hometown in Princeton, New Jersey. Princeton is the fourth oldest school in the U.S. and achieved university status the same year that it decided to relocate. It has one of the highest graduation rates in the U.S., along with 100,000 works spread across various collections in the Princeton University Art Museum. Princeton is also the only Ivy League institution to have no graduate programs, entirely focusing all its attention on the undergraduate student body. Columbia, the Ivy in the city and the school that Blair Waldorf transferred to, have long enjoyed a prominent presence and reputation in the public eye. There's more to this school apart from its pretty light blue colors. Columbia University was founded in 1754 as King's College by the royal charter of King George II of England. It's the oldest institution in New York and was renamed Columbia College when it reopened in 1784 after the American Revolution. It became Columbia University in 1912. It also was, unfortunately, the last Ivy institution to become co-ed in 1983. However, Columbia University is home to its sister school, Barnard College. Barnard College was initially established as an all-girls educational powerhouse to its male counterpart. Once Columbia became co-ed, Barnard reached an agreement that resulted in a complicated relationship that allowed them to operate independently as a liberal arts college under the Columbia University name. Columbia uniquely is the only Ivy League institution to offer 4 undergraduate colleges, Columbia College, Barnard College, School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and Columbia School of General Studies. Columbia's GS program was established for non-traditional students who have taken a year or more away from their education and want a more flexible environment despite their circumstances. Located in Morningside Heights, Columbia has its own environment that can't be replicated, an enclosed campus in the city. Despite the hustle and bustle occurring in the concrete jungle, Columbia's space offers a slightly more traditional campus experience than anyone would expect in the city. you can gain access to Harlem's rich culture and restaurants while also residing in the Upper West Side. Among the Ivy League universities, Columbia University boasts the largest graduate student population, encompassing 16 distinct graduate schools. Notably, their law, medicine, and education programs, including the renowned Teachers College, shine as prominent pillars of academic excellence. Brown. Known as the Happiest Ivy, Brown was founded on September 15, 1764. Nestled in the vibrant city of Providence, Rhode Island, Brown University stands as a testament to over two centuries of academic excellence and progressive thinking. Its storied history, dating back to its founding, weaves a captivating tale of intellectual curiosity and social activism. From its early days as a Baptist institution to its transformation into a non-sectarian university, Brown has been at the forefront of championing liberal education and the pursuit of knowledge. Brown is notorious for its open curriculum that gives students the opportunity and flexibility to complete coursework in a variety of fields of study without general core requirements. A grading system without grade point averages or class rankings. The option to take any course for a letter grade or satisfactory/no credit. Brown offers the power for students to chart their own academic course. Dartmouth. People call this school the party/frat Ivy, home to a large Greek life scene and major parties on the weekend and weekdays. Dartmouth is located in Hanover, New Hampshire, and ironically was founded by Yale graduate Eleazar Wheelock in 1769. Eleazar Wheelock was previously an American Congregational minister, orator, and educator in Connecticut before moving to New Hampshire to establish a school meant to train Native Americans as Christian missionaries, which later became known as Dartmouth, in honor of William Legge, the Earl of Dartmouth, a friend of John Wentworth's and a critical benefactor. John Wentworth, an American residing in England, was a critical piece in the founding of Dartmouth by securing the land and signing the charter for Dartmouth College. Despite not being mentioned as much as the other Ivies, Dartmouth still has many opportunities to offer, such as four different graduate programs. Cornell. The youngest Ivy League institution, or better referred to as the baby of the family. Like the youngest sibling, Cornell often is the butt of jokes when it comes to their older Ivy League counterparts. Founded on April 27, 1865, Cornell is the last institution to complete the band of Ivy schools. However, Cornell does have something over the other Ivy schools. They were the first institution to admit women since its enactment in March 1872. Even before they officially began admitting, it was stated that women could attend classes despite not being enrolled students. Cornell is also unique because despite classifying itself as a private Ivy League institution, some schools and land grants come from SUNY, State University of New York, funding. It was initially under the Morrill Act of 1862, a law passed that set land aside to create colleges that benefited the agricultural and mechanical arts. This institution resides in Ithaca, New York, where it acknowledges its land coming from the Cayuga Nation. It was founded by Ezra Cornell and Andrew Dixon White. With their unique study of agriculture, along with many other specializations, continues to attract students to this day. Final piece of advice. After reading this article, you are probably left with one question. How do I get into these schools? There's no one-size-fits-all for an acceptance letter. You could have the perfect GPA, spectacular extracurriculars, and fantastic charisma, but still face rejection. This isn't meant to discourage you, but it's meant to show that college admissions can be random, and even if you don't get into Ivies, wherever you end up will be lucky to have you, and that you'll do amazing things. But for now, whether you're already in college or you're merely a freshman in high school, I hope you've enjoyed learning more about the Ivy League. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Ron DeSantis's Florida Board of Education's new standards will teach about personal benefit of slavery. And this article was written by Eric Lutz. And there is a note. This article was originally published by Vanity Fair. Ron DeSantis's war on wokeness in schools ascended to dangerous new heights Wednesday as Florida's State Board of Education approved new African American Studies curriculum standards that, among other things, would force public school students to learn about some of the supposed upsides of slavery, a whitewashing of history that the state's largest teachers' union decried as a big step backward for education. Governor DeSantis is pursuing a political agenda guaranteed to set good people against one another, and in the process, he's cheating our kids, Andrew Spahr, president of the Florida Education Association, said in a statement blasting the new African American Studies standards. They deserve the full truth of American history, the good and the bad. Florida public school students may not get that under the new rules approved Wednesday, which require teachers, in a section on slavery, to note that slaves developed skills which in some instances could be applied for their personal benefit. In a section on Reconstruction and Beyond, a period marked by Jim Crow and routine white terrorism on black communities, the new rules dictate that students must be taught about acts of violence perpetrated against and by African Americans, which, as Democratic State Senator Geraldine Thompson pointed out, suggests incidents like the Ocoee massacre were sparked by violence from African Americans. "That's blaming the victims," said Thompson, who, as the Washington Post notes, helped pass a 2020 law requiring Florida schools to teach about the 1920 massacre, in which a white mob killed dozens of black residents of Ocoee, Florida, in Election Day violence. Manny Diaz, Florida's education commissioner, praised the charges, saying that this is something that is going to set the norm for standards in other states. The new standards came as DeSantis, a contender for the 2024 Republican nominee, escalates his war on so-called woke education, which has included book bans, the rejection of an advanced placement course on African American studies, and the passage of the Stop Woke Act, which prohibits the instruction of material that could make some feel guilt, anguish, or any form of psychological stress. His concern for the possible anguish of Florida students does not seem to extend to black students who could be forced to learn about the supposed benefit of slavery, nor does it seem to extend to LGBTQ kids and their families who have also been targeted in his battle. DeSantis expanded his Don't Say Gay law this year, and the Florida Board of Education voted Wednesday for rules that took it even further, including by barring teachers from asking students their preferred pronouns. Diaz said the move would protect kids from unwelcome influences and indoctrination, praising DeSantis, the legislation, and the board for what he described in a statement as their unwavering commitment to the health, well-being, and safety of our students. But as critics charged, the rules constituted an escalation in the politically motivated war on parents, students, and educators in Florida. "Our students deserve classrooms where all families are treated with the respect they deserve and all young people are welcomed," Jennifer Solomon, Equality Florida Parents and Families Support Manager, said in a statement Wednesday. Instead, the DeSantis administration continues to wield the state against us. "Stop turning our kids' classrooms into political battlefields to score cheap points," Solomon continued. But DeSantis, of course, shows no sign of stopping. His relentless culture war helped lift him to national prominence, and he has made it his central, nay, his only, pitch to GOP voters in his sputtering presidential campaign. "We've made the state of Florida the place where woke goes to die," he said in a recent campaign event. And now it is our mission as Americans to ensure that in January 2025, we leave woke ideology in the dustbin of history where it belongs. Our next article from theteenmagazine.com, STEM versus Humanities, Why We Need to Stop Labeling Ourselves According to Subject. And this article was written by Daisy Finch. When I arrived at university, I did so as someone who had grown up with very definite ideas about who she was. Exactly what I wanted to do and how that was going to work hadn't quite solidified yet, but I knew I had a gift for science, my main passion being maths. I thought it was beautiful. I've always loved solving problems, whatever form they take, and was that person who would request extra worksheets. I was proud of the work I'd put in and ridiculously excited about my grade. So arriving on campus, I seemed about as well set up for a maths degree as you can get. Well, it turned out quite differently, as it always does. Much though I wished to follow the Tiger Woods / Einstein / Stephen Hawking trajectory of superhuman talent propelling me towards an immaculate and rather smug destiny, it turns out the English education system's attempts to box us into one subject categories don't quite work for a lot of people. As proud as I am of the satisfaction I got at a job well done and still get figuring out a particular problem, side note, I was lucky enough to go to a university with a lot more flexibility than my first choice, so for those waiting on decisions, it really does tend to work out for the best. Focusing all my energy on STEM and abandoning my love for the humanities didn't work out how I had planned. When looking back at my academic career, the pattern becomes rather embarrassingly obvious. I've always been creative, and pursuing that on the sidelines was never going to be the best fit. There are really only so many times you can search for mathematicians with creative jobs without starting to reevaluate your chosen academic path. But planning from changing an English degree at 14 to diving headfirst into a maths degree 4 years later has shown me a lot about how easy it is to give parts of yourself up and how much our attitude towards talent and aspiration needs to change. One of the biggest issues with labeling ourselves as belonging to one of two academic camps is the idea that who we are is bound up in what we study. There's more to life, and there's more to who we are. Ideally, every person who attended university would do so to study something they felt passionate about, but it's a huge privilege to pursue a subject for the love of it, but with increasingly competitive job markets and financial pressures, some students are motivated by a need for survival without the luxury of choosing free from obligation. Even outside these huge pressures, those that pursue a subject that they excel in have so much to offer outside of this. No one person can be contained to the fact that they do biology, no matter what freshers' events or dating app introductions would have you believe. This can lead to an even deeper issue when students internalize this belief that their own core identity belongs to this particular subject. It only takes a small dive into history's notorious characters to see that the concept of specializing doesn't reflect the way most people are. Stephen Fry says it best when he argues for evading confining yourself to a job description or singular calling. We are not nouns, we are verbs. I am not a thing, an actor, a writer. I am a person who does things. I write, I act, and I never know what I'm going to do next. I think you can be imprisoned if you think of yourself as a noun. Stephen Fry. Some of the largest characters in our history have had an affinity for all areas of academia, motivated by learning rather than trapping themselves in the area where their genius more obviously lies, and when you examine your favorite artist, author, or academic, it's more than likely they've spread themselves across a wide range of interests. This same belief can then grow and embed itself so deeply within the concept we hold of ourselves that it starts to become a trap for a lack of self-belief. Once we get comfortable with the knowledge that we can do that one thing, we will keep doing that one thing and work in that one sector for the rest of our professional life. While it's an easier way to approach learning, something important is lost in closing ourselves off to all the opportunities that life offers, especially as a student. The dangers of boxing ourselves in. In closing ourselves off too soon, we're denying the opportunity for change. The most incredible parts of adolescence and life as a whole are the chances to explore who you want to be and what changes you want to make in the world. It's a stressful and overwhelming time of life, but the alternative is to keep nurturing the person you were at 12 years old, something I'm sure most of us are/will be glad to move on from. Growing and learning, especially as we gain more independence, means it's inevitable that everyone understands more about what they find value in and wants to pursue as a career. Sometimes a job won't be the top priority or something done just to pay the bills, so it's incredibly important to be able to find your identity in areas of life that you won't get paid or praised for. By removing the idea of being a STEM or humanities kid, we're taking off some of this pressure to find yourself in the things you do well, and by extension, what you might earn money in or base your core ideas of identity around. Without the pressure to live up to a standard of talent in a single area, it encourages students to think more broadly about the world and learn from others, without looking down on the more artistic/scientific sectors that are being pointless/soulless, like many lunchtime debates would have it. Taking this categorization away opens people up to being more respectful of others' achievements and less consumed by their own, allowing us to acknowledge ourselves as far more than an academic category. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.